Welcome to the Long-Term Investing Podcast with Baskin Wealth Management. I'm Barry Schwartz, President and Chief Investment Officer. In this podcast, we ignore all the noise and have conversations about the things that matter in today's markets. It's what we talk about with each other here in the office, and we want to share those conversations with you. Please stay tuned for our legal disclaimer at the end of the episode. Welcome back to the podcast. This is the first long-term investing podcast of 2026. Thank you so much for joining us. We have an exciting program to start off 2026. We're going to talk about Venezuela and oil and the impact on Canada. And then we thought we'd break down financial stocks in our portfolio and run through them. Financials had a very, very good year in 2025. We have a nice exposure to some of those names and talk about why we like them and what we see for the upcoming year. So before we get into that, let's get into this. If you like this podcast, of course, please subscribe to us on YouTube, on Apple, and on Spotify. Comments, five-star reviews, negative feedback, whatever you want to leave, we'd love to get it. And we'd appreciate it if you check out our website, baskinwealth.com. Lots of blogs, lots of videos, lots of podcasts. We also tell you when we're doing media, doing TV, and you can check out our long-term results and find out how we manage money. And if you're interested, obviously, please reach out to us. We'd love to chat with you. So with that, let's start off our 2026 podcast. How many podcasts do we have? We have close to 100, I think, already.
Well, it's gotten kind of wonky
on
the players because some, for whatever reason, they're digging up old episodes and resurfacing them up as new ones.
So yeah.
We have to look into that. But I think it's close to 100. Yeah. We've exceeded 100.
Yeah. And lots of shorts also. So, you know, clients can't say that we're not communicating to them about what we're doing and what we're thinking. It's all there, hours and hours of video. If you're so excited to listen to that stuff like we are, we love doing this for you and really, really appreciate all our clients and all your feedback and everybody paying attention. So obviously the big news of 2026 already, few days in, we had Venezuela, the president extracted. Yeah. From Venezuela, as well as maybe lifting of some of the sanctions, potential of U.S. oil companies going back into Venezuela and, you know, getting their oil infrastructure back up again. So, Ernest, why is this important? Why should we care as investors? And how does this impact our portfolio?
So the key is that we're looking at this from an investment perspective, because I'm sure there's maybe somebody listening out there who is an expert on Venezuelan U.S. relations who can speak to the kind of the geopolitical aspects to that. But yeah. I have, from an investment perspective, not really.
Have you been to Venezuela?
No.
No, I was in Aruba over Christmas.
Okay.
It's kind of close to Venezuela.
Are they?
Yeah, it's like 14 miles.
Okay.
Yeah, that's about it. It's very hot and beautiful in Aruba. Can't speak for Venezuela.
But I think the kind of the immediate reaction that a lot of people had about the Venezuela is the impact to the Canadian energy market. Mm-hmm. Because Venezuela is a massive energy producing country.
Some say it has the world's largest reserves.
Yeah.
Although it's not great quality oil. We'll get into that. Yeah.
No, so yeah. So I think the exact amount of Venezuelan oil reserves is kind of up for debate, because, you know, like they're, it's not entirely, the reporting is not super reliable in terms of how much oil they actually have.
Yeah, unlike Canadian Natural Resources or Suncor or Chevron or any of these companies you can name, where they tell you they have to be 100% honest with their reserves. Venezuela self-reports its reserves to OPEC, and I don't know if it's been independently verified or not. Hard to know.
But in any case, they have a lot of oil.
Yeah.
The type of oil that Venezuela has is bitumen, largely bitumen, which is oil sands similar to what we have in Canada. And as in kind of an interesting bit of trivia, which is that in the early 2000s, when the socialists came into power in Venezuela, they laid off a lot of energy engineers. A lot of them ended up getting hired in Canada were experts in oil sands.
Mm-hmm.
And so that has certainly been something that has happened.
So there's a little Venezuela-Canadian yep. connection with the oil sands.
So currently today, Venezuela is producing about 1 million barrels per day.
Mm-hmm.
I think...
Is that about 1% of the world's demand, give or take?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
A lot of that ends up flowing to China, mm-hmm. from what I understand. They used to produce about 3 million barrels per day, mm-hmm. but have really underinvested in the resources that they have in terms of the pipelines, the ports, the actual resource that they have.
I guess cocaine and fentanyl make more money. Okay.
Yeah. And so I think that's been kind of the challenge, mm-hmm. and the opportunity
yeah.
that the U.S. oil companies see in Venezuela.
So there were many U.S. companies at one point operating in Venezuela. Chevron, ExxonMobil right. had operations, completely left them. Who knows if they've been looked at for decades.
Yeah.
And yes, you said they produce 3 million barrels per day.
Used to.
Now they're at 1 million. Maybe it goes back up to 3 million. Yep. Maybe it goes higher. There's a lot of reserves there. And you can see why countries want access to Venezuelan long-term reserves.
And the kind of the hot take on the impact to Canada is that it's bad for Canada because a lot of the U.S. refineries they want heavy sour crude, mm-hmm. from Canada or from Venezuela or from wherever to turn into things like gasoline.
So there's specific refineries that were built to handle the conversion of the bitumen into
heavy oil, yes.
Heavy oil into the regular oil that we yeah. all love and use.
And
these refineries are built all across the United States, right? Some of them in Texas and Louisiana, yeah. some of them
Midwest.
The Midwest refineries service the Canadian oil sands, and in the past, I guess the ones Texas and Louisiana service the Venezuelan.
Yeah, so a mm-hmm. lot of the refineries were built to process heavy crude,
yeah.
in anticipation of the supply coming from Venezuela and I think Mexico to some extent yeah. too. What ended up happening is that because the supply didn't come, they ended up relying on Canadian crude,
mm-hmm.
and the fear of you can see this in the stocks of the Canadian oil sands producers, is that going forward, they will no longer be as reliant on Canadian heavy oil.
Makes sense. And the infrastructure is built to flow from Canada to the United States.
Yeah.
There's no other refineries to service it. We're not independently yep. Strong here in Canada to refine the bitumen here ourselves, and there's no refineries that make sense to ship it offshore. So this is the conundrum that Canada is in, right? We have an abundance of oil, abundance of the Canadian oil sands, just like Venezuela. So why would the U.S. want Venezuelan oil, for example, or over Canadian oil?
Well, I think the more oil access you have, the better.
Mm-hmm.
No, I think the fear is a little bit probably overblown, mm-hmm. in terms of the kind of a practical impact to Canada, because Canada today is about, I think, 4 million barrels of exports to the United States.
A day.
And most of that is to the Midwest,
mm-hmm.
where Canada, they are essentially completely reliant on Canadian crude because, number one, there's no oil there.
Yeah.
And number two, the pipelines connect directly to Alberta.
So let's say there's 1 million barrels of oil that starts flowing from Venezuela to the United States. Would that mean that the U.S. would use 1 million less of Canadian oil?
It could.
Okay.
Plausibly. It may certainly displace Canadian crude, especially in the Gulf Coast, mm-hmm. and also potentially displace Canadian crude in the export market, because currently a lot of Canadian oil, well, not a lot, but like some Canadian oil is making its way down to the Gulf Coast for export.
But it's a commodity, and all you care about in a commodity is to be able to buy it at the cheapest price
right.
and sell it at the highest price.
Right.
Right. And so if it comes from Canada or Venezuela, who should care?
And so
I guess unless you're trying to punish a country to achieve your results.
So it'll be more, I think, in the medium term, it's not too likely that you will see too much change in terms of the energy flows. I think longer term, it's, first of all, we don't even know how Venezuela, like how the transition of power.
It's all talk now. There's no yep. details. It's all talk.
We don't know how that's going to play out. We don't know if the crude that China is currently importing from Venezuela, like, will China now need to look to Canada for alternative sources of oil? So there's a lot of different factors which, you know, kind of have to balance out.
In the meantime, we'll in the meantime, if you look at estimates from prognosticators on oil demand, it grows 700 to 800,000 barrels per day per year, right? The demand. So let's say there's an extra 2 million of Venezuelan oil flowing into the world. That will be eaten up by demand over the next 2 to 3 years anyways, presumably if the economy, everything being equal.
Yeah, well I think that's the challenge for oil, which is that it's kind of a global market that is with a lot of kind of geopolitical aspects that you have to navigate through.
And we talked, of course, that the U.S., a lot of their oil fields are depleting.
Yes.
So
shale oil.
Yeah. So, I mean, you can come at this with a lot of reasons why this happened. Obviously, the stocks falling, the Canadian oil and gas stocks falling, makes sense. A new uncertainty has been added. You could maybe say that the Canadian oil and gas stocks were over-earning because of the relationship that it had with the United States, and that may shrink back. However, you know, demand in the world continues to grow each and every year, and people are looking for safe and secure oil sands. As well as governments don't last forever.
Yeah.
All we know is what we can see with the operations of the Canadian oil sands, which have been tremendous, long life assets, great technology, infrastructure is already there to take it to the United States. You know, will this push Canada to be more aggressive to start building infrastructure to get our oil into other nations? Probably it will. So I think it's short-term pain, long-term gain.
No, and I think maybe one last point on this is that we own Canadian Natural. Mm-hmm. And our thesis has never been that we thought oil prices were going to go up. Yeah. Because if we did, then you wouldn't own Canadian Natural. You would own a smaller, more levered oil company.
That's right.
But the thesis was that this is a very well-run company that has, you know, done a great job in building its reserves at attractive prices at times when the Canadian oil sands were out of favor, buying assets that other companies didn't want and operating them well.
Yeah. You also don't know what Canadian Natural Resources is going to do in the next 1 to 3 years. Maybe they'll make a large acquisition outside Canada, right? You just don't, maybe that will reduce its reliance on Canadian oil sands.
Well, they do have like North Sea assets.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So I guess what I'm trying to say is things will come and go in the short term, but it seems clear that the tailwinds for oil demand are very strong going forward. It's clear that Canadian Natural Resources is a best in class operator. You and I talked about this yesterday. Their production costs have barely gone up over the last few years. Right. Even though everybody's complaining how expensive labor is and food is and building materials, everything's gone up. Yet Canadian oil sands has been able, Canadian Natural has been able to keep costs so effectively low that it can be very profitable even if oil fell another 30% from here.
Right.
Right. And meanwhile, oil prices have been kind of stable since this Venezuelan incident.
Yeah, they've been fairly weak in 2025.
Yeah.
Overall, I don't, you know, again, like we don't have a, I don't have a particularly strong view on what oil prices are going to be, but very confident that Canadian Natural is still going to make money even at low oil prices.
That's right. And so for long-term shareholders of Canadian Natural, nothing really should change. You should expect increasing production year over year. You should expect best-in-class operations. You should expect the dividend to grow. And if oil prices do surprise to the upside, because anything can happen, it will be more aggressive in returning capital to shareholders. Right. In the meantime, what are you getting? Over 5% dividend yield today for a company that's raised its dividend 25 years in a row?
Right.
So, if anything, it's a much more attractive buy, in our opinion, today versus where it was trading at on December 31st. And we'll see what happens in the long term.
Sounds good.
So financials, As well as gold, were top sectors in 2025
in Canada,
sure. And U.S. Some of the financials, yes, did very, very well. We happen to have North American financial companies. We own a couple of Canadian banks. We have insurance with Berkshire Hathaway and Power Corporation, and then we have some, I guess, non-financial type companies like Moody's and MSCI and Visa, right?
TMX Group.
Yeah, TMX. Yeah. And TMX Group, of course. So
they're financially type.
Financially type, sure. So it was, if the markets have a record year, you should expect financials to do well, right? They go hand in hand with each other, right? Stronger markets mean more IPOs, mean more loans, more bank wealth management earnings, trading, you name it, and it filters across the entire universe with financials. Stock markets at record high, people have money, they go on vacations, they spend more money on their Visa card, right? It all goes hand in hand together. Financials are not so fun to own when markets stink.
No.
But you know, what's done obviously very, very well in 2025 were the Canadian banks. It wasn't really a thesis breaking year in the sense of the earnings were so amazing for the Canadian banks. They were better than expected, but really I think the banks had low expectations coming into 2025, and that's why they had a strong performance.
Yeah, I think for the Canadian banks in particular, they mostly really just benefited from the strong markets,
yeah,
where the wealth management business and the capital markets business, so the trading and the investment banking, and that is almost, especially the wealth business, is almost one for one with the stock market.
So they're levered.
If the stock market goes up, yep, you know, earnings go up. If stock market goes down, mm-hmm, earnings go, mm-hmm, down, mm-hmm, right? And so I think they've really benefit a lot of the stock price performance for the Canadian banks is really beta.
Explain what beta means. For
beta is kind of sensitivity of performance relative to the stock market.
Okay.
So if you have the S&P 500 in financial lingo, yeah, it has a beta of one, mm-hmm, where if you have a company that their earnings are and their stock price is heavily tied to the performance of the market, then it has a high beta. Companies that are non-correlated with the market, so take something like Coca-Cola,
for instance,
utility,
yeah,
they have a low beta.
Yeah.
And so that explains most of the strong performance for the Canadian banks in 2025.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's very rare for banks and financials to have a bad year when the market's up.
Yes.
It just doesn't compute.
For the Canadian banks,
yes. Especially for the Canadian banks, yes.
And that was true for companies like Moody's and TMX Group as well, mm-hmm, where for TMX Group, a lot of people were, like, trading activity was very strong, and fundraising activity for a lot of the, you know, the smaller, especially the gold sector. Mm-hmm. These companies wanted to raise money, which generates fees for the TSX exchange. And as people were, you know, meme trading stocks or, yeah, whatever, that is also additional fees and volumes,
yeah,
on
they
TSX.
They have an ETF business which designs exchange traded funds based on different themes and, yeah, memes, you name it. And I guess with the AI and the gold, all you know, a lot of thematic investing worked really, really well in 2025. And I guess those that launched those type of funds saw pretty good inflows, and that helps TMX Group for sure.
Right. And so I think, yeah, when you look at a company like TMX Group, I think it feels good that you had the stock price go up so much this, yeah, year, but that isn't an investment, to your point. That's not an investment thesis in the sense that you could have seen what was coming at the beginning of the year.
Yeah.
Because
no one knows what the stock market is going to do in any one year.
Right. Because that was really just the stock market doing well. And so the stock.
And in fact, most of our clients who called us in January were very worried that it was going to be a terrible, terrible year for the market. And their fears came true in April with what happened with the tariffs. But, you know, it ended up, you know, somewhat pretty good here.
And so what I think I really pay more attention to for these companies is what are they kind of doing beyond the participating in the market rally?
Absolutely.
Right? And so,
because if you're going to buy them based on what you think the market's going to do, good luck to you.
You could just buy the market.
Yeah, just buy,
yeah,
the market.
Yeah.
But we're buying individual companies. We're taking an educated bet on the management, the business, yeah, the operations, the tailwinds. And, you know, that's our approach to it. And so, yeah, in any one year, anything can happen. And of course, we'd love it if our stocks go up every single year. But what we're more looking for is, you know, the trend in the fundamentals, the improvement in the quality of the business.
So I think one thing that I thought TMX Group did a good job of, which is a really a continuation of the strategy that they've been on for the last decade almost, yeah, is transitioning the business towards more recurring revenue and analytic type
and
services.
And outside Canada, right?
Yes.
They're trying to reduce their exposure to the listings, as you said, the trading business, and buying these proprietary data sets that they can sell to others. And so far, most of their acquisitions in those areas worked out quite well.
Yep. Yeah. And
but is it all beta, of course? Is it just that they've ridden a strong stock market over the last few years that's...
It could be.
Could be, yeah.
And so in 2025, they made a couple acquisitions, small ones, mm-hmm, that are really focused on the issuer services side. So helping companies that are listed on the TSX, yeah, you know, with trust services and those
kinds
of things.
All the fun stuff.
Yeah.
We call that the plumbing of the financial industry.
So yeah, they've been really trying to gain market share in that, which I think they'll be reasonably successful at. Yeah.
It is interesting, though, we saw a headline today where JP Morgan says it's going to use an in-house AI to take care of all their proxy statements.
Whatever that means.
Whatever that means. But as the world changes with AI, it will be interesting to see which businesses do get disrupted. You know, what services people used to pay for that they may not have to pay anymore.
Right. Mm-hmm. And kind of similar for Moody's, yeah, where they had a really good year again, where I think the stock price itself was kind of but
it had a nice day, like January 5th or something. Yeah.
But I think kind of where you are today is that everything is almost Goldilocks for Moody's, mm-hmm, because spreads are low, interest rates are falling, mm-hmm, the economy is, yeah, whatever. But
I mean, credit is pretty good.
Yeah, credit is pretty good. Default rates are low, and companies are, you know, starting to get more enthusiastic about making mergers and acquisitions. So as a result, like demand for bond ratings is quite good.
They'll also tell you that there's trillions of bonds that were issued 5 years ago, give or take, that are going to come due.
Right.
For those that recall during the pandemic when interest rates dropped, companies went crazy issuing, yep, debt at, you know, very low rates and probably issued 5-year debt, 7-year debt. And so that type of stuff is coming due now. And either the companies, probably most of the companies, don't have the cash to buy, yep, back, so they'll have to repaper, and repapering means going back to Moody's and paying another fee to get, yep, your bond with the credit rating.
Yep. And so the one other thing that Moody's is benefiting from is the cracks in the private credit market. Mm-hmm. That has been a big concern, or that has been a point of concern for Moody's, in that is private credit, so institutional money raising funds, selling and then putting those loans into private funds for institutional investors.
Yeah. Why do people like them? Because they generally have much higher interest rates.
Yes.
And if, I guess the theory is, if you diversify across a number of them, your risk is lower. And with interest rates coming down, it's attractive. Of course, the corollary to that is they're illiquid.
Yes.
And you're taking riskier loans. So bad things can happen to private credit. And we're, as you said, we're starting to see some cracks,
yep,
in private credit, right? A lot of private equity companies complaining that they can't IPO their, yep, companies, that there's fewer sellers, fewer buyers, and that's a problem.
Yeah, the worry specifically was that instead of raising money from rated bond, the public bond markets, mm-hmm, where you would get a bond rating from S&P or Moody's, you would go to private credit instead.
Yeah.
Because it was more flexible. Maybe you were able to raise a larger amount. But I think what happened, especially in 2025, was that we started to see private credit issuers start to come back to the public markets, mm-hmm, because they're seeing that the cost is cheaper. And in many cases, like there's just no need to go to the private credit market anymore. So
we always say to our clients, there's no free lunch. especially in fixed income, which is supposed to be purchased for safety.
Yeah.
We'll never buy fixed income for risk. It's just no thank you. We'll take our volatility with equities. And yeah, I get it. When fixed income pays 3-4%, you know, and you don't want to stomach that because it's not a livable wage, you look for alternatives, but you get what you pay for.
I think the worry for Moody's, certainly in 25 and going forward, is that, you know, we're in good times now, but like, is this as good as it's going to get?
Yeah.
Right. And I think that, you know, I think certainly if you look at the history of credit, it goes up and down and it's kind of ebbs and flows.
But in the meantime, Moody's is aggressively buying back stock. Also always on the lookout for acquisitions, right? And so it's using the cash flow that it generates to always try and improve the quality and the growth potential of its business, right? So even if the thesis peaks in the short term, maybe the business is continuing to improve because of the acquisitions and capital allocation.
Yeah, and I think the big, on the acquisitions part, I think the big kind of big picture story for Moody's is that over the last 10 years, they've really been pushing the analytics side of the business, mm-hmm. where it is now about half of revenues, about 20-30% of profits, depending mm-hmm. on mm-hmm. the year. And that's a recurring revenue business that is not tied to, you know, the bond markets.
And many clients and many will ask us, why do we prefer Moody's over its competitor, S&P Global?
Yeah.
And the reason is Moody's, we think, has better exposure to credit ratings, which we think is a better business versus the analytics division. And Moody's generates more of its profits from credit ratings.
Yes.
And both kind of say trade at a similar valuation.
Yeah. And one last thing about Moody's maybe is that they've been kind of quietly making little minority investments, or in some mm-hmm. cases, not majority investments, in local credit rating agencies around the world. Mm-hmm. So they did one in Egypt this year or last year. They have, and so now they have stakes in credit rating agencies in Latin America, in China, mm-hmm. in Africa.
Why aren't they buying these companies outright? Is it local government regulations, probably?
I think that in many cases they probably want to leave some local ownership with the operator there. I think that these are often local rated bonds for local investors, because a lot of the bond demand in emerging markets is, you know, purchased locally.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so they have a different...
You mean we never call up our broker and say we want to buy some Chilean bonds?
Maybe one day.
Maybe one day, but yeah.
And so the rating scheme is different from what kind of international bond investors are used to.
Got it.
But these are, you know, these are long-term growth opportunities that Moody's mm-hmm. has a finger mm-hmm. in mm-hmm. to look forward to.
Okay. And similar to analytics and proprietary data sets that TMX and Moody's has is MSCI.
Yeah.
MSCI did not have a robust year in terms of stock performance.
Yes.
Stock was down a little bit, although it clearly had a great year on fundamentals, right? I think we haven't had the 2025 final year numbers, but expectation is for double-digit earnings growth, almost high top line, single-digit revenue growth. Company was aggressively buying back stock. CEO Henry Fernandez, who's already, I think he's a billionaire, is buying more shares of the company. That's a good signal. MSCI, like TMX, it's beta related. If the market,
some of it, yes,
some of it. So it does have some upside to stronger markets. So it's a conundrum to me why the stock didn't actually perform better.
No, and it was surprising to me too. Yeah. Like, obviously, you don't know what a stock's going to do year in or year out.
I mean, if we did, we wouldn't be sitting here.
Oh, maybe we would.
Yeah. Okay.
But yeah. No, but I think what was especially surprising is that MSCI focuses on international indices. Mm-hmm. And it feels like a long time ago, but back in April and May, the big talk about investors was everybody was going to leave the US.
Yeah.
They were going to start investing in international markets.
So they sure did.
Which was going to supposed to benefit MSCI.
Yeah, well, it didn't.
They did.
Yeah.
Their ETF business was up like
21%. Yeah, no, I'm just saying it, but it didn't show through the stock price.
Exactly, exactly.
Yeah, I know. Unfortunately for our clients, international markets had strong years. And yep. We don't have a lot of exposure to that. But I'm surprised that MSCI, the thesis didn't pick up. Anyway.
No, it has. It absolutely did play out. Mm-hmm. In the fundamentals, where I think international markets are benefiting their ETF fees.
Yeah.
I think the flows are benefiting some of the managers that they have.
Yeah.
And then they've also been doing a good job of diversifying their client base outside of kind of traditional asset managers, mm-hmm. which is now over half of their business.
Well, wonderful.
So I think they're doing a lot of great things. And
I mean, one note about MSCI, of course, is the company came into 2025 with a high valuation, right? It's a great business, absolutely terrific business, right? I think how much CapEx does this company?
Nothing, basically.
And it generates close to 80-90% margins on some of its business line. Terrific business. You were paying a high price for it. We think it delivered on the results, but in any one year, anything can happen with stock prices. But we feel really confident about MSCI as we head into 2026.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Sounds good. And so the last name we want to cover is Visa.
Yes. Yeah. So Visa, I think the stock was all right.
Yeah.
In 2025.
Yeah. I think it had a pretty good finish. Some of the payments companies had very volatile years.
Yeah.
At one point, and I don't even want to get into discussing stable coins because that's, but that was a worry that, settlements would happen with, off the Visa and MasterCard networks and how that's going to play out. And is that a risk? I think there's always worries about regulatory fines. I think Visa actually had to come up with a few billion dollars to settle one recently. But the economy turned out to be quite fine. And as a result, I think Visa is, as per usual, double-digit top and bottom line growth for 2025. And I think they gave a pretty good guidance already for 2026. And as the economy rolls on, as long as people are traveling, and I mean, the world is a very uncertain place, but the Visa, is a good bet on global growth, if you want to play it that way.
Yeah, I think there were a couple points of chatter, so to speak, on Visa. Number one is whether stable coins and cryptocurrencies could potentially be a disruptive threat to the card networks. Mm-hmm. And the motivation is that they're kind of fast, they're instant settlement, and why should a merchant pay like the interchange fee that to settle Visa transactions when they could accept stable coins and not have to pay that?
I guess they can accept stable coin. I mean, the whole thing about Visa is or MasterCard is bringing a network of buyers to your store, right? And if you don't accept it, then you may not get the customers, right? If you're only going to take cash or stable coins or, I don't know, barter, then maybe you don't get those customers, right? So you have to accept what the people want.
And this also played out in the antitrust settlement case, where now in the U.S., merchants are allowed to discriminate credit cards based on their tier.
Okay.
So if you have a Visa Infinite that you earn like extra reward points on, then the merchant can say, well, if you want to use this card, you have to pay a fee, right?
Yeah. Well, it's a tricky subject, of course, and it depends on the merchant. Maybe local mom and pop shops can be more stringent about it, but course, a Costco can do whatever it wants. But you walk into a grocery store and they say, "Sorry, sir, we don't take this card and that card and this card." I may never show up there again.
Right. Yeah. And I think it'll ultimately depend on the merchant.
Yeah.
Like a lot of the restaurants that I eat at, they don't take
cash only.
It's cash only or debit.
Yeah.
Right. They don't take Visa at all.
But they also offer you a discount for cash, right?
Yeah. So there's a cash discount.
Yeah.
Or debit.
Is that legal?
And they don't accept credit at all.
Is that legal in Canada?
Guess so.
Well, we won't name the restaurants just in case.
But no. But I think I think the one aspect about the stable coins that is maybe not appreciated about Visa and MasterCard's business model is that there's no incentive for the issuer to use them, mm-hmm. right? Because or the consumer.
No.
Because from our perspective, we use credit cards because they're convenient and you get
the points.
You get your points.
Yeah.
And from the issuer's perspective, you are the issuers are the ones who are making the bulk of the interchange fee, not Visa.
People right? want life to be so easy. It's so easy just to tap your Apple iPhone or your Google phone and pay with things. Take out your card. God only knows. Adding a new wrinkle with stable coins, good luck. Maybe it works for part of the demographics, but a lot of it will never adopt to it.
Right.
You know, we know a lot of people that will still never even shop online.
Right.
Scared to put their credit card into the computer.
Yeah. So I think that there's just, if you look across the, you know, kind of the value chain, consumers don't have the incentive for stable coins. Issuers don't have the incentive for stable coins. Mm-hmm. And like merchants do have the incentive, mm-hmm. but ultimately they're the ones that need to accept payments because they're the ones selling the product. So I don't like, and you see this from time to time where in the EU, for instance, they recently announced that they were going to try and use a digital currency to displace the credit card networks.
Okay.
Right. And these things never work again, because of the incentives. Yeah. There's just not the incentives to do so. So I'm not super concerned about the disruptive threat from Visa's perspective. And I think that, and then beyond that, I think they're doing a lot of interesting things with regards to agentic commerce, like allowing the use of AI to make purchases online on behalf of you.
And are people actually doing that?
Not yet.
Yeah.
But I think it's great that Visa is working on solutions so that if you're buying a pizza in ChatGPT, you're still getting the same fraud protection and all the benefits that you get from shopping
that using stuff Visa. Is so right? important.
So that's really the key. Mm-hmm. And I think it's a well-run business that we're happy to own.
I mean, the bottom line for Visa is it really is economically sensitive. Right? It takes a percentage of global spending.
It's
somewhat.
Yeah. It's economically sensitive in mm-hmm. the sense that consumer spending goes up and down, but it's not economically sensitive like a home builder where mm-hmm. sales can fall like 50%.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Because a bad year for Visa might be like up 4% instead of up like 10%. Mm-hmm. Right? And so, and you have to, the other aspect is that they benefit from inflation as well.
For sure.
Because they're just skimming a top.
That's right.
A portion of the top, right?
That's right. Well, you used to spend $500, $200 on groceries. Now you're spending $500. You're still paying with your Visa yes. card. Visa loves it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Very good. So I hope you got a nice taste of what we have to offer for 2026. More types of chats like this. We'll make sure to cover big tech in our portfolio. We'll talk software. We'll continue to talk oil and gas. Other financials like the Brookfield Complex. Ernest is researching a number of new companies. There may be some more trades on our portfolio. We'll just see. But the bottom line is, as we head into 2026, we're very, very confident in the companies that we own. Clients will always call me up and say, what's new? What are you buying? I'm buying what I currently own because we love them. Some of those companies did not have the best 2025 stock performance-wise, but their fundamentals improved. So in a sense, not only the stock get cheaper, but the intrinsic value of the company also got cheaper as well. So you have a potential for a rebound on some of these companies if we see some better news going forward and a rotation out of maybe some of the sectors that worked. No sector works every single year, right? Gold was the winner in 2025, but if you look at, you know, the charts of gold, there are many, many years where it did nothing for you. And no question with our types of stocks, they were working really, really well the last couple of years, maybe didn't have the best 2025. But that tells you nothing about what's going to happen in 2026. We always say it over the long term, the stock price is determined by the earnings that the company generates. And so we're going to stick with companies that produce strong fundamentals. And we are very confident that over the long term, the stock price will follow if the company has great results. So that's all we got for you today. And we'll see you back here real soon. This podcast is for informational purposes only. And any forecasts on the economy, markets, or individual securities should not be viewed as investment advice, a recommendation or an offer or solicitation to buy or sell any securities. Clients of Baskin Wealth Management and the speakers on this podcast may own shares of the companies discussed. Information on this podcast is current as of the time of production and is subject to change. If you have any questions or would like to subscribe to these podcasts, visit our website at baskinwealth.com.